Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to episode 3 in the new series, Chaos Theory. Joining me, as always in this series, to bring the chaos is the man himself, Michael Cow, the Urban Cowboy. Hi, mate. How are you?
Hello. How are you? Great to see you, Grant.
Likewise, mate. We've only done two of these so far. The response to both has been fantastic, and it's such a fascinating area to discuss this, I think.
I find for myself that as we go down this rabbit hole together and ask questions, the questions beget more questions, right? To set the context for today's conversation, now you notice that one of the questions that I've actually posed to our first two guests is, will there ever be an Asian equivalent of NATO? And today's guest is perfectly suited to answer that question. I met Scott Smitson at West Point in February, where he presented an interesting paper on alliance management in the Indo-Pacific. And in the shadow of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, it got me really wondering about how, if conflict were to erupt in the Indo-Pacific or the South China Sea, how we would go about coordinating all of the different overlapping alliances out there. So that is the topic for today.
All right. Well, why don't we welcome Scott to the podcast? And I see him joining us. So let's bring him on in.
Hey, gentlemen. Good afternoon, and I guess good morning. How are you?
Hey, Scott. We're doing great.
No, very excited to be here and excited for the opportunity.
What we like to do, because every guest on this has a resume far more impressive than either Michael's or mine combined, so we love to give people a little sense of the background of the people we're talking to, because you guys have such fascinating, deep, and varied backgrounds. So why don't you give people a sense of what kind of brought you to where you are today, if you wouldn't mind?
I've got a really, really interesting background, much like some of your previous guests. The big part of my military career was as an Army strategist. And when you hear someone talk about being an Army strategist, that usually involves some combination of developing strategy. Like I helped develop the national security strategy or the national defense strategy, operational planning. How do we come up with war plans for the types of fights we think we may get into or we are going to be into, as well as policy. So how do we work across government and sometimes with other governments to go about thinking about how we implement policies going forward? And about halfway through my Army career, I transitioned from being in ballistic missile defense, so that Patriot missiles, things of that nature, and then found out that you had the opportunity to go into this career program where the Army would send you to graduate school, and then you would operate at that echelon of strategy development, assessment, and planning. And so after I got selected for that program and finished my graduate school, I was a faculty member at West Point at the Department of Social Sciences, where I started a program on strategy there, taught courses on foreign policy, on conflict studies, things of that nature. And then really after that, it was just a successive series of opportunities to work at very fairly high levels, both within the United States, but also abroad. To help develop strategy and advise on strategic planning issues. And, you know, I'd say just a few high points. Following my time at the U.S. Military Academy, I had the opportunity to work not too far from where you are, Grant, in the U.K. Ministry of Defense, and had a great opportunity to be really responsible for Africa strategy for the MOD, which was very, very unique as an American. Towards the end of my time there, we started to focus more and more on this group called ISIS. And that then work then helped parlay into my next job, advising on strategy for the entire Middle East, for the part of the U.S. military that's responsible for that part of the world called U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM. The commander at that time is the current Secretary of Defense, Secretary Lloyd Austin, then General Lloyd Austin. And that was just an interesting time for the United States, because the Obama administration was shifting the way in which we thought about our footprint in Afghanistan. How do you deal with the nuclear Iran? What is the future of America's presence in the Levant? And so these were kind of repeated issues that came about. Following that, some time in the Pentagon, where I worked on strategy development and, quite frankly, strategic assessment. How do we ensure that the resources or the strategies that we have are aligned with the types of challenges that we can foresee? How do we forecast these things? What are some different ways that that we can look at that? And that was a truly global perspective. And my last military assignment prior to retiring was the head of strategy for U.S. Southern Command, which is our command that's responsible for Latin America and the Caribbean. And that was a very, very interesting time because it happened during COVID. And so you were confronted with all these challenges of how do you maintain presence and influence in the midst of a pandemic? How can a pandemic shift the geopolitical reality of the places where you want to be? And what are your rivals doing at the same time? So it was constantly what can the United States do? What's China doing? What's Russia doing? What's Iran doing? So on and so forth. And so all of that military time, if there was one major thread that really cross-cut all that, was not only thinking about things at a strategic level, but having an appreciation of what it means to work with allies and partners. One of the major platforms of geostrategy, if we think about it from an educational and academic perspective, is the nature of alliances. How do these things work? How do they not work? And I can tell you throughout all those experiences and over 2+ decades, the United States can't do what it does without its alliances and partners. And a previous chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said that America's alliance structure is its strategic center of gravity. So the thing that gives it its strength. And so if the United States does not maintain those alliances in a way that's fair and equitable, you have challenges, right? I've always kind of had that thread. It's in some of my scholarship. I advise private sector companies right now on geopolitical risk. How do the things that we're seeing impact the way that corporations think about long-term strategy, operational risk, and just risk maybe in different ways they haven't thought of before? As I know you and Michael know, the international business community, we've operated in a fairly benign environment since the Berlin Wall came down, 9/11, 2008, and a few other things notwithstanding. But what does this new kind of reality mean? And then last but certainly not least, I also view my service to not only my country, but to the global community in the ways that I engage the next generation of thinker doers. And so I do a little bit of teaching. I am a visiting professor at a place called Denison University. It's really been great to kind of bring both the soldier scholar, the thinker doer, the theory and practice together, both across public, private, and nonprofit domains. So just a little bit about me, but thanks again for the opportunity.
You worked and reported directly to the Joint Chiefs for a period as well, right?
Yes, that's correct. So for our listeners that may not be totally familiar, the Pentagon is an interesting place. So all the armed services of the U.S. military have their headquarters there, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. And then in addition to that, you have a big part of the Pentagon that's there to exist and support the Office of the Secretary of Defense, right? Which by U.S. law is a civilian. The U.S. system, the military is always subordinate to a civilian authority. It's not only good for civil military relations, but it's a way that we see to maintain the state and safeguard democracy. Later on in the U.S. history, we created the Office of the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The chairman is the senior most military member of the U.S. Armed Forces, but he and one day she, they are an advisor to the President and Secretary of Defense. They're not necessarily in the chain of command. However, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the staff that support him have a huge role in standardizing and bringing about unity of effort across the armed services, who then produce the forces that then the commanders out of places like CENTCOM, EUCOM, INDOPACOM have to deploy and use and try to create strategic effect. And so that work at the Pentagon, Michael, was just a great opportunity to go from thinking about things from a theater perspective, right? This region, that region, but now having to look at things from a global level. And what are the different trade-offs of risks and resources and opportunities that you have to keep in balance and think about with a very, very large organization with somewhat unknown futures. And in doing that requires having sensitivities to not just what's happening in foreign policy, but in your own nation's domestic politics, as well as the domestic politics of other nations. So it was a really, really great developmental assignment.
When we met at West Point in February, and I listened to you present your paper on Alliance Structures, I thought, wow, this guy is somebody I really need to get to know, because clearly your paper stood out to me as one that not only explained the complexity of the situation, especially in the Indo-Pacific, but you actually had actual policy recommendations, which I thought many, many more academic papers lacked. So maybe we can segue to that topic real quick and talk about your paper. Your paper was entitled The Quad, AUKUS, and Beyond, Adapting Extra-Regional Alliance Mechanisms for the Indo-PAC. And in our preamble, I mentioned that one of the recurring questions in chaos theory so far that I've posed to each of our guests is, will there ever be an Asian equivalent of NATO? And I know that you have certain views on that. But before we go there, you had a very interesting graphic in your paper, and we'll try to include it in our show notes, that showed this interesting overlapping of the various economic groupings as well as security groupings within the Indo-PAC. Perhaps you could help us walk us through that interesting interlocking web first and help us demystify the complexity there.
Yeah, and perhaps, Scott, if you could kind of lay out what the AUKUS, the Quad, and the Five Eyes are, because they're, you know, they're these things that we kind of hear, they spring up into consciousness out of nowhere, and before you know it, it's too late to ask for a lot of people, and so there'll be some people wondering what these are, so if you could lay that out, it'd be wonderful.
Sure, and I think to do that, if it's okay, one of the things that I'd like to do is just kind of lay out maybe the foundation of why this paper, why now. And I think one of the many things, and we can maybe talk about this later, but one of the many things that the current war between Russia and Ukraine is doing is it's forcing major capitalist democracies, both in the East and West, to rethink their security. What is the nature of the security? And the war is really driving a convergence of interests between what I call the North Atlantic security community, mostly NATO, but it could be a few others, and kind of the combination of different bilateral, so one country to one country, as well as multilateral security arrangements in the Indo-Pacific. And so while there's kind of commonality of long-term interests, maintaining a free and open Indo-Pacific, ensuring that the use of force is not used to expand territories, preserving what many call the rules-based international order, so that world, the structure of the world in which we've lived in since 1945, each of those different parts of the world, though they want to work together, have very, very different organizing structures. So if I take Grant, for example, the North Atlantic. The North Atlantic security community has a lot of different relationships in it. But the one that matters most and the one that all the allies have agreed to as being the location to drive consensus and make priorities is NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, right? Just last month, NATO had their most recent annual summit in Vilnius, Lithuania. If we think about North Atlantic security, and the immediate image that comes to mind when we think about alliance structure is NATO, right? Now, the EU is trying to kind of come up with their own security and defense policy. You have other things like the OSCE, but NATO really is the name of the game. When we look at the Indo-Pacific, however, there's, as you and Mike said, there's no NATO. There's different types of both formal arrangements, right? So the United States has, you know, by international law, treaty alliances with the Republic of Korea, with Japan, with Thailand, with Australia, with New Zealand, just for example. But then there's other arrangements. You know, in the title of the paper, it talked about this idea of the Quad. The Quad is an informal series of relationships that was actually the brainchild of former prime minister, unfortunately assassinated last year, Shinzo Abe of Japan. And when Shinzo Abe was looking at and considering the challenge of China, he said, look, we have to look about this through a much, much wider context. And so it was Shinzo Abe who was the first to really start talking about the Indo-Pacific, right, in his writings in Japan. That soon started to kind of expand the use of that language in other strategic and security writings globally. And so what the Quad really is was Abe's idea of thinking about how do we bring together an arrangement of like-minded or closely like-minded democracies that could collaborate on certain things in a shifting strategic landscape in the Indo-Pacific basin. And so what the Quad is right now is Australia, the United States, Japan, and India. but it's not a formal alliance. However, this group is meeting more and more frequently. It's gaining more and more prominence. They were supposed to have a meeting on the wings of the G7 in Japan earlier this year. Right now, as we speak, there's a major exercise that India always sponsors off its coast. That exercise now is happening off the coast of Australia. And it's usually just India and the U.S. Now this exercise, as we speak, is India, Japan, the U.S., and Australia. So you see this as kind of this combination of countries that are working more and more closer together. Will it ever be a formal alliance? No, and we can get into many reasons why. But perhaps you don't need a formal alliance to get to that, to the effect that you're looking for. AUKUS, on the other hand, is a formal legal agreement and alliance. And AUKUS is an acronym, AUKUS, which stands for Australia, the UK, and the United States. And this was an agreement that was made last summer. And most of the attention of the agreement focuses on the sharing of nuclear propulsion technology between the United States and Australia, and the support of the Britain's Royal Navy and the US Navy to help Australia develop their own organic nuclear submarine capability, not nuclear weapons, but nuclear propulsion. The reason why this was such a big deal for Australia was for the longest time, most of Australia's submarines were diesel powered, which means it can only go out and patrol for so long and then have to come back, right? You're seeing, and I know, I think we may get to this later, Australia and some of the other countries that we're going to talk about have changed the way that they conceptualize the security environment in the Indo-Pacific. 15 years ago, not even 10 years ago, you probably would not have had an Australian domestic political body that would have cared about having nuclear-capable submarines. But now with the war in Ukraine, now with the challenges of China, countries are rethinking this. There's another aspect of AUKUS, too, which isn't in the news as much, but a significant amount of work and research and development on things like AI, hypersonics, many, many other kind of what we consider leap-ahead technologies. And so this is going to be something to watch going forward. And even just today, it was announced that the U.S. Navy is going to help the Royal Navy in the development of their next class of British nuclear submarines, and they're going to be called the Dreadnought class. So anyone who has any familiarization with British naval history, the Dreadnought means something, right? So those are just kind of two examples of running the gamut of formal structures to informal structures. And so the Indo-Pacific, in my estimation in the paper, is much, much more a combination of different types of structures that kind of overlap. And the image that Michael was mentioning a second ago really tries to basically lay out these different groups. And it's just kind of a big Venn diagram of both security mechanisms, but also economic mechanisms, right? Some of the same players that show up in the security realm are also either a part of or aspire to be a part of some of the major economic trade blocks that are in the Indo-Pacific. So the CPTPT, the ASEAN members. So the UK has applied to become an observer in ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. So Grant, Michael, it's just the paper really, I kind of just saw these things happening even before I retired. Because usually countries dealt with things on a regional basis. But then you started to see regional countries and powers think about things globally. Last year, and I'll pause after this, just a quick vignette. Last year at the NATO summit in Madrid, Spain, the leaders of Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and Korea attended. It was the first time in history that the heads of government of those countries came to the NATO summit. Those countries also were at the NATO summit last year in July. At the NATO summit last year in Spain, I was in a room and there was a question to the new Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese of Australia. I said, why does Australia care about this? Why are they even here? And he said, the last time that Australia had to deal with an existential threat, it was because of destabilization that began in Europe, but then had emanating second and third order effects globally. It drove opportunistic malign behavior. So again, I use this vignette to show that even countries that are in the Indo-Pacific are thinking about their security in the Atlantic Basin and vice versa. And that was the real motivating aspect of looking at this paper and seeing, okay, well, what does this look like from a nation to nation relationship perspective?
Scott, I know Michael's just champing at the bit to ask questions. I'm going to jump in here quickly to get one at you before we turn him loose like a junkyard dog on you. I've been really surprised as we watch this, and I think what you just said there was perfect in giving a sense of the urgency that's kind of sprung up around a lot of these agreements in recent years. And it's really struck me that I don't know whether it's sitting on the outside, it looks as though there's been this almost lax approach to security, that this calm global order is going to last forever and we don't need to think about potential threats. Am I right in thinking that the way this has all kind of happened over the last, I guess, kind of 10 years, it's kind of been bubbling away, has caught people by surprise? Or has it just been an acceleration of associations and groupings that were kind of in play already?
I think you're right. And while there were some things that existed before, there's something called the Five Powers Defense Arrangements, which is this thing that goes back to the end of British imperial presence in Southeast Asia. It always existed, but the current geostrategic environment is driving these old existing agencies to think anew, right? 3 years ago, Emmanuel Macron called NATO brain dead. Now NATO has a purpose, right? NATO is being driven in ways that it hasn't before. But to your other point, there is a huge flurry of these new arrangements. I've talked about AUKUS, I've talked about the Quad. There's other ones that maybe don't get in the news as much, but that matter. I mean, the UK signed what we call a reciprocal access agreement with Japan just a few months ago. This allows the two militaries to use each other's territories for exercises, for training. And though that may sound a little bureaucratic, it's huge because it's allowing countries to kind of share sovereign space to conduct things in the security environment. And that's a game changer. But to your other point too, the United States, we sometimes say things about the Europeans of cutting their defense and, you know, shame on you. But the United States did it as well. Everyone wanted a part of the peace dividend in the 1990s. I always tell my students, the U.S. Army that invaded Iraq that I was in was not the U.S. Army that liberated Kuwait 10 years before it, right? So right now, the change in the environment, war on a mass scale in Ukraine is causing all these countries, especially democracies and ones that rely on meaningful economics to drive their national security, to rethink all these assumptions, right? And so hopefully that answered your question, Grant. Sorry.
It's perfect. I mean, as I say, it's just taken me by surprise how many almost emergency, particularly in the case of Australia. Australia's had this incredibly cozy relationship with China for such a long time now, and it's been incredibly symbiotic and suited everybody so well. So to see the Australians in that position where their economy is completely reliant upon China, but to see the kind of, I don't want to use the word desperation because I don't think it's that, but the fervor with which they've been trying to strengthen the countries around them in these agreements has been really quite surprising to me as to how they've tried to make this happen so fast and in so many different directions.
And a lot of times the driver of that, not necessarily is the United States prodding, it's when countries look and examine how have our domestic political institutions or our economics been adversely influenced by different, you know, psychological warfare, information operations, cyber, messing with elections. And so in a country like Australia, it took that and some other things for the entire political spectrum in that nation to say, we have to have that conversation. Just 2 weeks ago, about a week ago, actually, New Zealand released their new defense strategy. It doesn't really talk about China in the way that maybe our strategy does, or the Aussies do, or the Japanese do, the UK does. But you can see that New Zealand does not conceptualize its part of the world now as necessarily benign. The things are shifting. And again, this is something that you wouldn't have expected during the previous Ardern government or any before to really kind of want to talk about. Michael and I have talked about this with some of our colleagues in Canada and Ottawa, right? So countries are starting to have this conversation internally, which then is driving their foreign policy externally, most especially in the way they think about alliances and coalitions.
In your paper, you introduced this really interesting term, this polycentric, decentralized model of all of these alliance structures in the Indo-Pac versus the centralized NATO model. So I thought maybe we could talk about that a little bit, because I guess the thing that I struggled with initially when I read your paper was, well, gosh, with this complex interlocking web of all of these different formal and informal structures, who coordinates policy actions in the event of some kinetic conflict? Or in the case of some of the economic groupings, are there any economic coordinations, especially in this new era of economic warfare? So maybe you can talk a little bit about that, but maybe talk about the economic coordination, but also we can then talk about maybe the military coordination aspects.
When it comes to the economic coordination, it appears and it seems as if with a lot of these major countries that we're talking about, the UK, Japan, the United States, Canada, and others, tend to use existing very, very formal, very, very senior consultative mechanisms to discuss long-term economic planning. And right now, that's usually been the G7. So the G7, the group of seven of the most advanced democratic economies. It used to be the G8 after Russia invaded Ukraine with the Little Green Men in 2014. They were kicked to the side. And so it seems as if, and definitely in the both in the Biden administration and even Boris Johnson, when the UK was hosting the G7, have seen that entity as a major one to think about economic coordination. So the G7 was used heavily to think about what the economic response would be to Russia's invasion in February of 2022, right? So what are the different economic levers from a central bank, central government perspective, and sanctions could be done? But now the G7 is also asking and helping coordinate these thoughts about long-term supply chain resilience, for example, or a major issue that we've talked about a lot in the past, this issue of using export controls as a way to kind of create off-ramps for control of you know, things that really, really matter. Right? There's a great book called Chip War, which kind of really talks about how if the 19th century, the commodity that you went after to influence economics was coal, and the 20th century is oil, the 21st is silicon, right? And so the G7 is being used to kind of orchestrate these types of discussions. Now, the U.S., early in the Biden administration, the U.S. set up a technical standards and coordination body, an export control body with the EU. That sometimes is in the news, sometimes it's not. But the G7 tends to be kind of at the highest level where you see these type of discussions happening along economic levels. And those are usually about either trade sanctions, financial type ideas, or issues when it comes to access to or access denial of parts of the global supply chain or value chain of things like we're seeing with microchips.
So you would say that the G7, at least from an economic umbrella perspective, really is the main coordinator of economic policy, as opposed to the regional Indo-Pac groupings like ASEAN or CPTPP, et cetera.
I think if you want to think about it from a global perspective, I would say yes. I mean, ASEAN is going to be focused a lot more on regional issues, and they have the sensitivity to the fact that most of the ASEAN countries' major top trading partner is China, right? Whereas I think that with the G7, you have a little bit more of a broad range of things. And you're starting to see even countries from the G7 that were part of Belt and Road now kind of winding that back. So the new government in Italy, for example, one of the concerns was how right-wing will the new government in Italy be? One of the things that we've seen, this new Italian government has done a lot of positive outreach to the Biden administration and has said, we're going to walk away from Belt and Road, to the surprise of many people who focused on these things in Europe. So one of the things that's fascinating, Michael, and I'll get back to your question, is at the beginning of this invasion of Ukraine, there was the thinking that we would go back to kind of two major blocks, right? So liberal democracies relied on capitalism on one side, state government-driven economies and autocratic on the other side. What's been interesting, though, is there's a big chunk of the world that has not wanted to take a side, right? Parts of Latin America, parts of Africa. So it's interesting to kind of see where this is and is not shaking out on that. And obviously, our countries, you know, the Commerce Department, Treasury, they will conduct consultative mechanisms below the president or prime ministerial level with great frequency. But there's not necessarily a economic kind of command and control structure like we do with having an Indo-PACOM, right? Or at UCOM or any of these regional combatant commands where we have representatives from those countries. They're focusing primarily on the military instrument of power. on security issues. But as we know, there's no clean dividing line, if there ever was, between security, economic security, climate issues. It's this confluence of things, something that a mentor and I wrote a paper on about this idea of compound security that governments are wrestling with right now. It's the interface or the intersectionality of these different challenges and threats. It's one of the reasons why the China challenge is so hard for a country like New Zealand, who is part of, they're a treaty ally with the United States. They want to maintain a security and intelligence relationship with the U.S., but they also want to maintain a positive trade relationship with China because it matters to their economy. Can you have both, right? And so this is the challenge that many countries are trying to navigate right now.
On that theme, as we get into the economic side of this, because obviously a lot of these countries that have these security arrangements have economic ties between them as well. When you're thinking about strategy, how do you account for the fact that along with this kind of global peace dividend and this really calm international waters we've had for such a long time, not only are we starting to get geopolitical tectonic plates shifting, but also economic ones in the sense that countries that have agreements on a security basis may be forced to do things on an economic basis that are in direct conflict with those treaties. I'm talking particularly about, you mentioned Africa there, and I'm sure we'll talk about Africa later on, given what's going on there at the moment, but also parts of Asia where no matter what your security pact is, we are in a time now of economic necessity. And so how do you guys as strategists factor those things into understanding how things will shift in the future? Because they seem to, come very quickly out of nowhere.
No, this is a great question, Grant. I mean, one of the things that you have to do in developing strategy is to understand the echelon or the level upon which your strategy is seeking to create effect, right? So you could be charged with a strategy of increasing interoperability between the Korean Army and the U.S. Army, right? A fairly standard way of, strategy assignment, a homework assignment, if you will. But as you're saying, something that's much, much more higher level than that, that's where you get to the bounds of where military strategy ends, and you get to where what I call grand strategy begins, right? Grand strategy being the way in which nations pursue their interests in peace or war using all the instruments of power. I know you're familiar with the acronym DIME, diplomacy, information, military, economics. Some have added to that. Finance, law. And so when you're a uniformed military person and you're working on that then requires you to work in what we call an interagency context, or as in Whitehall, they would call it cross Whitehall or cross government. So when I was in the MOD and we were working on Africa issues, I spent a ton of time at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office across the street, because the Foreign and Commonwealth Office was the lead for, it was the Cameron government at the time, of the UK's face on certain Africa issues. You have the same in the United States as well. And so you saw similar things in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where the military had a lot of resources and assets, but they couldn't necessarily solve things that were not necessarily military problems. They could enable, but they couldn't bring all the expertise to bear. So if you get to our very, very senior high levels of military organizations, you will have representatives from our State Department, our diplomatic corps, from the Department of Treasury, from our intelligence agencies. And so those are always things. Once you get to that level of planning, you create planning and strategy teams then that the military may only be a slice of the representation. How do you kind of take into account all the different aspects of things? And all these organizations that I just named each have different strategic planning cultures, right? The military, we like to plan long-term. We like to identify assumptions, identify risks, come up with options, and do it. Diplomats want to have freedom of maneuver in the diplomatic realm because things are always constantly changing. Diplomatic advances happen as a function of positive social capital. Where does that go? Same with the development community. And so it's a great question. It's one that takes a lot of time and patience and a lot of learning and understanding to do. Especially when you then get into areas where government interests start to overlap with economic private sector interests. So,
where does China sit in all this in terms of its offset strategy? Because, on the one hand, this decentralized model can be a very resilient model because perhaps it's more difficult for China to so-called slice the salami. And to shed some light on that term, the term salami slicing usually refers to China's attempts at isolating parts of alliance structures into specific bilateral negotiations where China obviously has incredible economic negotiating power. And so they're able to slice off little components of the salami. But I guess I'm curious how you see China offsetting this decentralized approach. And one of the things that you mentioned to me was that the Western powers at least have this importance of these historical legacies where we've had 300 years of successful track record in maintaining these alliance structures. Can China hope to compete there? And what are they doing to offset?
Well, this is a good question, Michael. And I think both if you look at the behavior of China and even Russia since this conflict in Ukraine has started, anywhere where you can exploit wedges within kind of this broader democratic, you know, block of nations, it helps further their goals and objectives, right? And so you can, if a country necessarily, let's say the United States is supposed to visit Indonesia not too long ago, and President Biden was supposed to go but couldn't at the last minute because of issues with our budgetary process in the United States. Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, went instead, which is still a very, very senior person, but it wasn't President Biden. That played off in social media from Chinese sources, both informal and formal. And so there's a significant kind of information warfare element that tries to, you know, drive some of these wedges out there. And one of the challenges of having, as you said, this kind of overlap of multiple reinforcing organizations and arrangements is that then exposes you to fissures and wedges, right? NATO, obviously, everything has to be done by consensus. There's well-established processes and procedures by why things happen. But there's nothing that you know, it's very, very hard, if you could say, to how do I align what happens in the Quad with happens with AUKUS or a U.S.-Korea bilateral relationship. People think about these things, right? But that structure may not necessarily be there in a day-in, day-out basis. And so that's going to be one of the challenges. To your point about the historical track record, going back to the times of ancient Greece, but definitely more recent, you have this tension between land power, what we call land powers and geostrategy, and sea powers. And over the last few centuries, the dominant kind of win-loss ledger has gone to sea powers that mostly were democracies, mostly global in their orientation, had the ability to police and master the commons, and when necessary, project force on either end of the Eurasian landmass to create favorable balances of power to challenge land powers who wanted to upset the status quo, right? You know, during the Napoleonic Wars, Britain didn't necessarily have a huge presence in Europe, but it put forces on land when it needed to, and maintained important coalitions at sea to deny Napoleonic France advantages in the economic realm, right? Until a coalition on the ground could be put together to defeat Napoleon, right? The World Wars, same thing. You had land powers in Europe trying to expand their power across parts of Europe, but then have access to the sea, right? Something I know, you know, Grant, I'm sure, you know, I know a lot about these things as well. And so we see this dynamic play out, land power, sea power. And one of the things that I think has driven coordination is many of these sea powers, their prosperity is a function of maritime-based trade. Even today, 97% of the world's goods are shipped globally at sea, right? Not on land. The majority of all the information technology that powers our online business transactions, undersea cables, 90-some percent of what we do on the internet is happening under the ocean somewhere right now. Very little of it comes through satellite feeds, right? And so that control or influence of the global commons, especially in the maritime and in the air, really is key and essential. And to your point, Michael, these coalitions that were able to resist and challenge the land powers did so because they had mastery or command of the sea and had the ability to project force when necessary into Europe or in Asia to defeat threats.
this is touching upon something super interesting. So we talked about how this decentralized model's vulnerabilities are these different wedges that China can exploit through its salami slicing techniques. But I see a big strength of the decentralized model to be the actual decentralization and being able to fight what Richard Lackament calls, you know, an away game. So historically, in the wars that the US has been involved in, we've pretty much, outside of the Revolutionary War, we've basically fought mainly away games. And the way we've been able to do that is to leverage our alliance structures and their historical footprint. So I thought it was interesting when you talk about maritime powers and you talk about the different spheres of influence in the Indo-Pac, I'll note that the UK, France, Japan, and the US have all been historical maritime powers. You know, in your paper, you had two additional maps that were really, really eye-opening to me. One was showing the spread of the UK Commonwealth nations in the Indo-Pac. And then perhaps even more eye-opening to me was the spread of the French military presence in the Indo-Pac. So maybe we could start with those two and then you know, obviously talk about US bases and also Japan. I think that'd be really interesting.
Sure, Michael. And as you said, one of the things about alliances is not just what type of political support they provide or material support or fighting capability, but where are they on the map, right? And one of the things that's fascinating, and I'll do a little bit of a dive in the UK, the previous government before Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, Boris Johnson's government, came up with a new strategy about 2 years ago, an integrated security review that said that Britain's long-term security and prosperity would be a function of its engagement in the Indo-Pacific region. And they talked about the need of what was called the Indo-Pacific tilt. And really what this tilt was reorienting its security and diplomatic focus on this region in ways that we really hadn't seen for decades. By the early 1970s, most of Britain's military presence east of the Middle East, what kind of referred to as east of Suez, had been dialed back tremendously. But quietly, over the last 15 years, well before this discussion of AUKUS and the challenge of rise of China, you've seen a re-interest by the British government in reestablishing what they call presence points in places like Oman. The Royal Navy has a brand new, newer base that's in Bahrain, doubling down on its presence in Kenya, things in the Indian Ocean going forward. And so you have that dynamic going on from a British security perspective. And you also have the fact that while the Commonwealth is definitely not an alliance, it provides soft power influence for the UK with some countries. And it just so happens that some of the most desired real estate in the Indo-Pacific region, a lot of the small islands, are also Commonwealth members. So that is in my paper, I talk about how that's an asset by which UK foreign policy can think much, much more globally. When it comes to France, what's really interesting about the France example is, unlike, let's say, Commonwealth countries that are now independent, fully sovereign, or alliance countries that the UK has a relationship with in the Indo-Pacific, like Australia, France has significant overseas territory in the Indo-Pacific region that they view as still sovereign French. You have to excuse me, my French is not good, but in French parlance, it's called the Outre-mer. These are the outlying areas of sovereign France. And in my paper, one of the things that I found interesting in my research, 93% of France's exclusive economic zone, so in other words, the part of the ocean where they have right of first refusal of trade protectionism, is not in the English Channel and is not in the Mediterranean. It's in the Indo-Pacific. And it's because of areas like French Polynesia, New Caledonia, and other areas in the Indian Ocean, like an island called Mayotte, which is near Madagascar, which mattered a lot in World War I, because you base submarines there to interfere with things coming in and out of the Suez Canal. France still owns all this stuff. It is still seen as French.
That blew my mind when I read that in your paper. 93% of France's exclusive economic zone is in the Indo-Pac, with 7,000 troops permanently posted there.
They deploy their aircraft carrier, the Charles de Gaulle, quite frequently there, their nuclear-capable bombers throughout the region. France was the first European country to write an Indo-Pacific strategy. They did so a few years ago. Because of this largesse in the area, Emmanuel Macron refers to France as an Indo-Pacific power, routinely. And there's been this notion that France wants to play a balancing role with some of the countries that really matter to it. They just refreshed their own Indo-Pacific strategy, and they called out the importance of Australia, India, and Japan in their strategy. At the beginning of our conversation, we talked about the importance of these countries from an American and British perspective. So you can see there's coincidence of interest. The challenge is bringing about harmonization of ways, right? France believes in this idea of strategic autonomy. There's been a long time tension between France and what they call the Anglo-Saxon powers. And so you have these dynamics happening. And as you said, they have a robust military presence. But for a very, very long time, the U.S. military hasn't done much in a training or an exercise perspective with this massive, sizable French military presence. So the federal think tank RAND wrote a paper just a few months ago about opportunities for the U.S. Army to train with the French Army in the Indo-Pacific. And it's a well-written paper. There's a lot of good ideas there. But it just brings this idea that, you know, there remain areas of collaboration that have not really been actualized or fulfilled.
Do you think that, the current conflagration in the African Sahel countries, like, these formerly French colonies of like Mali and Niger and, you know, to name a few, does that help or hinder the ability to get France on board with the rest of the AUKUS objectives in the Indo-Pac?
So this is a good question. And if I can, Michael, I'll hit the AUKUS point first and then maybe go to long-term. One of the ways that France saw as furthering its influence in the Indo-Pacific a few years ago was signing a contract with Australia with a new fleet of submarines. Now, these were high-end diesel submarines, but they were not nuclear submarines. Australia walked out on that contract, knowing there would be significant financial penalties, to join AUKUS. And that really put an issue in French-U.S. relations, obviously with French-Australian relations, but definitely with French-U.S. relations. And what I think is interesting for our listeners to kind of look at is if we want to conceptualize a bridge between the North Atlantic security community and security in the Indo-Pacific, through kind of a NATO lens, the U.S. is driving that through London, not through Brussels and not through Paris, right? So it shows you kind of the level of trust and also confidence in where this kind of bridge building, as the Biden administration calls it, between East and West is happening. The other thing that you're seeing France do, though, is want to further its relationships with countries like Japan, with India, and I don't think that that's necessarily going to change. Now, to your Sahel point, well before this wave of coups started tearing through Mali, Burkina Faso, and obviously in the last 2 weeks, Niger, there was, in French domestic politics, there was the concern that the counterterrorism presence there was not bringing the effect that they desired. And in fact, as the levels of terrorism attacks in the Middle East were going down, the Western Sahel right now is the most dangerous place in the world for terrorism attacks, more than any other parts of the world combined. So this is the new epicenter, the new flashpoint of the global conflict against violent Islamic extremism. And so, but even in spite of that, the pressure to kind of change France's priority and posture in the Western Sahel was there before some of these coups started. And then when these coups happened, much like us, we're not going to maintain a relationship with a government that overthrows a democratically elected government. So there's a little bit of kind of retrenchment happening there. And obviously that's being compounded with France's support to the war in Ukraine. A few months ago, there was a large kind of diplomatic blowback when, during a trip to Beijing, Emmanuel Macron talked about how it wasn't necessarily the interest of France or Europe, quite frankly, whether or not there would be a crisis in Taiwan. And this set many, many people aback because, again, is this a potential fissure within the North Atlantic security community? That's been kind of walked back a little bit, but it's in keeping with this idea of wanting to maintain strategic autonomy for France. And this is something that goes back well before Emmanuel Macron, not necessarily being tailored to what the Anglo-Saxon countries view as priorities. Some of that may be slightly imagined, but some of it also is this need to kind of have balance. And France's latest strategy paper, they talk about needing to avoid geopolitical blocks, I'll point out that the Australian Foreign Ministry uses the same language all the time when they appraise what the United States is trying to do in the Indo-Pacific, creating geopolitical blocks. So this is a tension for France. How can France be a leading security entity within the European Union, right? Which is really calling out China on many things, but not necessarily, but wanting to maintain strategic freedom of maneuver away from necessarily what the United States and the Australians and the British are doing.
There's so much of this is about balance. And I think as we talk to you, we get a much enhanced sense of just how tricky a lot of these balancing acts are between political, economic, different alliances that you may be a part of. But coming back to this, what's happening in the Sahel here, and my earlier question about how these things have caught everybody by surprise, when you talk about these kind of shifting geopolitical landscapes and you're trying to wrap in the economic side of it, when you see what's happening in Niger, and more importantly, I think the language around what's happening there and a lot of kind of pushback against the West and France and Western democracies and all this, you know, us and them. There's a lot of us and them talk right now. And then you take that over to the BRICS nations, which we're seeing a lot of that going on as well. There's us and them, and there's a lot of posturing about the dollar and how the system is slanted heavily in favor of the West. And look, the reality is it is and it has been. And I can understand why they're looking to shift that. In the financial community, there are lines drawn and everybody is on one side. They're either, the system is never going to change. The dollar is the reserve currency forever. It's not going to change. And the other guys are, the dollar's finished tomorrow because now everyone's, you know, getting fed up with it and the BRICS are going to come together and trash the dollar. How do you guys think about that? Because to us, it's such a pivotal thing. The reserve currency, the reserve asset, the dollar's place at the heart of the global financial system. Certainly for me, I often wonder when we come to the geopolitical and the military strategizing of this, if people think of the dollar and the financial system as important a component as perhaps we do in the financial side of things.
This is a great point. And I think the last year and a half has kind of really shown in stark relief both the power, but also the limitations of financial instruments, right? Economic warfare. I believe in your last podcast, you talked about this with, you know, if you use sanctions too much, will then incentivize countries to come up with alternatives, either alternatives way to trade commodities, alternatives ways to move finance. One of the things I talked to some people about, you know, Russia's interest in the current war, civil war in Sudan is not just because it's going to give business to Wagner. It's because Sudan produces a lot of gold. And as the ruble is cratering, more gold as a commodity on hand is good for Vladimir Putin, right? So there's an economic dimension to all these conflicts, right? Either from an incentive or from kind of a punishment factor. You know, when it comes to military strategy, and whenever you develop a strategy or an operational plan, you're given a list of things that influence the type of plan that you have to draw up. What we call constraints and restraints, things that you have to do in a strategy or plan, things you're not allowed to do, right? And so a lot of times those will be given from very, very high, you know, the top of the Department of Defense, but that will be informed by things and discussions that happen in the National Security Council or from the President of the United States are influenced by U.S. law, right? The U.S. military is very, very powerful, but by Title 10 of U.S. code, there's certain things we can and cannot do, right? And so you have those limitations. I think where you start to kind of see that reach into the economic space is when we think about trade opportunities, foreign military sales. You know, this is always a major, major incentive. This was definitely an incentive when it came to our relationship with the Gulf countries. My time in the Middle East, one of the ways that the U.S. government satiated the concerns of the GCC nations when the Joint Comprehensive, the JCPOA was going to be signed with Iran was, well, what type of, you know, we want to get the top of the line missile system. We want a qualitative military edge with our jets. Now, just using some examples. So there's that. But I think there's the broader aspect, which you're talking to, which is really outside the military and much, much more at that grand strategic level, which is thinking about economics well outside just kind of the military domain. And again, this goes back to the ideas that we talked about 20 minutes ago of control and influence of the global commons, right? They are the highway by which things come and go. You know, one of the things that geostrategy is concerned with are what we call strategic goods. These are things that nations and companies need to thrive even during times of crises and conflict. right? And so one of the kind of the positional advantage by which the United States and China and Russia are other doing is trying to find ways to achieve a presence in areas that matter on the map. And even if they don't matter right now in a time of conflict or crisis, they could. Access to energy, access to infrastructure to move things. We are talking about France. One of the reasons why France had significant interest in Niger is because of the uranium there, right? France has an independent nuclear energy capability that's been part of the way that that country has viewed itself for a very, very long time. So stability in Niger has a significant economic dimension to a country like France in ways that it maybe doesn't for Canada or the United States, right? And so it really matters kind of where you sit and seeing how these things play out have an effect, even if our bureaucratic lines dividing, divisions of labor, see these things as agnostic. We know at the very, very high level, you have these constant trade-offs, right? And it's for strategists, not just in the military, but at the highest levels within our government, as well as our elected officials in Congress, to be sensitive and to understand these things.
Now, going back to BRICS for a second, it's quite notable that India, the I in BRICS, has bailed on BRICS. So where do you see, going back to the key powers in the Indo-Pac, where do you see India in all this in terms of both an economic and security perspective?
I think India is key in my, I'm sorry to go back to my paper, but I think that was my number one or number two recommendation for the, not to use an American football analogy, but to go along with its relationship with India. And this has a lot of challenges, right? There are many, many people in the United States rightly have concerns with the direction of the domestic politics of the Modi government, but there are others who see the value of furthering the U.S.-India dynamic. Just a few months ago, the second state dinner the Biden administration had was with India. Prime Minister Modi was here in the United States. You're seeing, I gave the vignette of the maritime exercise that India usually hosts with the United States. That's gaining more and more prominence. The Quad initially didn't focus only on security issues. It was kind of about diplomacy. It was about values. It was a little bit about economics. But its tone has taken more and more of a hard edge towards security issues. And that wouldn't happen if India wasn't willing to kind of discuss that, right? So just kind of review our, you know, to remind our viewers, you know, India is a country that shares a border with China, fought a border war with China in the 1960s. 2 years ago, there was significant fighting between the armies of both countries at altitude. And India is also bordered by Pakistan, who has significantly strong ties with India. So India's calculation of things, to say nothing of the fact that, much like France, they have a strategic culture of autonomy, right? The non-aligned movement during the Cold War had it as its birth, India, modern India as we know it, is always there. But it's the largest economy. It's the largest country by population in the world. All the indicators are its economy is continuing to grow. And as major Western companies want to, what people in the EU now call de-risking versus decoupling supply chains, you're seeing major firms starting to shift more and more business to India. You know, Tim Cook has been in India a lot recently. Apple's going to shift anywhere from 20 to 25% of their manufacturing from China to India, right? It'll cut into profits in the short term, but in the long term, it's seen as a good thing. And you're seeing more and more people do that. So I think both on the economic and in the security dimension, you're seeing the importance of India come out more and more. And you see that in what the United States is doing. But as I mentioned earlier, if you look at the behavior and the foreign policy documents of the UK, of France, and other countries of Japan, India is key and crucial. If I can, maybe, Mike, if it's okay, if I give another quick vignette about economics and security and geography all mattering, one of the things that most people who study China's foreign policy and their naval behavior is how China could get at a potential disrupting distant blockade of the Straits of Malacca, right? Most of China's energy that's not coal-based still comes from the Persian Gulf. Though that the oil that comes and the natural gas that comes through there has to go through the Strait of Malacca, which is far away from the South China Sea. And it's a natural, what we who study sea power talk about, it's a geostrategic choke point, right? It's a funnel. And some would say, not all, but some would argue that one of the things that motivated Belt and Road was to try to create an on-land go-around to avoid needing to be in a Malacca dilemma to begin with, right?
I call them Malacca hedges.
Exactly, right? And so that area really, really matters. Well, it just so happens, if you can visualize the Indian subcontinent off its coast to its east towards the Strait of Malacca, there's a chain of small islands, the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. The military presence there for India is key and essential because you can monitor and track everything that comes in and out of the Strait of Malacca. And right now, the Japanese government, not us, the Japanese government is helping the Indian military enhance what they call their maritime domain awareness capability there, which is maritime domain awareness, MDA, a sexy or nerdy way, depending on how you want to define it, is a way to understand what's at sea, how fast it's coming, where's it coming from, where's it going, how do we track it. Right. And so I just see that as an example of kind of what you said earlier, of where even if the Indo-Pacific doesn't have this hierarchical centralized architecture like NATO is, relationships, bilateral relationships, India, Japan, if India is stronger at tracking Chinese economic or military naval activity coming in and out of the Malacca Strait, that's a good thing. And the United States isn't even necessarily paying for it, right? But Japan sees it in its interest there. Japan's doing a lot of, it's not quite on the scale of Belt and Road. So one of the things that the G7 did in their last meeting is they came up with an alternative to Belt and Road funding. The name of the program escapes me right now. But Japan's done a lot of developmental things and infrastructure that are of a dual use nature in the Indo-Pacific as well, right? So you see a lot of these things happening, and it's all based on strategic geography, the global commons, the way in which we can present risk, and where these countries take advantage of their geography for both strategic and potentially operational effect if we ever got into a conflict.
You just jogged a couple of thoughts. So one of the strengths I see of this decentralized approach is that it's an offset to this narrative that if we have big vulnerabilities in our super carrier group where China can just use hypersonics and target our super carriers, what if we had these distributed logistics all throughout the Indo-Pac? Scott, can you talk a little bit about that? I think you mentioned to me that there's this Marine Corps initiative that takes advantage of what I believe you in the military call literal warfare. I think that would be very interesting.
Yes, no, and if I can maybe set the context for this as an issue. You know, one of the things that motivates our understanding of why China would want to kind of strike at our carriers or things at distance is to delay an inevitable American or allied kind of counteroffensive response to a provocative activity. Let's say the beginning of an invasion of Taiwan. And the idea is by keeping the U.S., what I like to call the Iron Mountain, out and away as far as possible, China has the ability to consolidate whatever operational gains they would have, like an invasion of Taiwan or somewhere else, and then make it so it would be very, very costly for the United States to bring overt military force and presence through what we call the first, second, and third island chains. When you think about these as concentric circles of land emanating out from China's coast, and in so doing, get it to the point where a war would be so cost prohibitive that America's political leaders and others would say, you know what, we're not going to get involved in this, right? And for about 10 to 15 years ago, there was significant concern of what was called anti-access area denial, that while the United States was fighting the global war on terror, its adversaries in Russia and Iran and China and North Korea saw that one of the ways you prevent the United States from being successful is you do not allow them the luxury of building up force near a combat zone and then allowing them to turn it on because you can't stop it. The Serbs couldn't do it. Panama couldn't do it. Saddam Hussein couldn't do it in other areas, right? And so it's maintaining that standoff distance in cultivating relationships with small island nations like the Solomon Islands, who signed an agreement with China, a security pact that also it says, hey, don't allow the United States Navy or the U.S. Coast Guard to come into harbor to take on fuel. It's all about creating that space, right? And so related to that, as you said, was this idea of targeting big naval flotillas at distance to prevent that, allowing them, you know, our forces come in concentrated in a certain area. They can be targeted at distance. The United States loses 5,000 sailors if a carrier gets sunk, and so on and so forth. And so we're really seeing a radical shift in thinking is this idea of distributing force, but still being able to concentrate effect, right? And so the U.S. Marine Corps, the previous commandant of the Marine Corps, General Berger, who just retired, really wanted to change the way that the Marine Corps thought, conceptualized about things in the littorals, right? You know, the Marine Corps also hadn't really been doing a significant number of amphibious fighting and training because they've been running around the deserts of Afghanistan and Iraq for the last 20 years. And so the thinking was, rather than conceptualizing World War II with better tech, right, mass Marine Corps units landing on beaches and doing these things, by distributing forces and leveraging technology, you then set it so that it's cost prohibitive for China to try to strike every single target that they think is out there, right? So I'm totally making up this number, but to say there's an airstrip somewhere China wants to take it, in their estimation, they need 15 missiles to take it out, to have a 95% confidence level that an airfield is taken out. Imagine if you can create multiple airfields, regardless of how good or they are. Now you're injecting ambiguity in China's strategic calculation. And with this, and there's been interesting reporting that's talked about not only the Marine Corps, but the Air Force is doing something that they haven't had to train for since the Cold War, which is thinking about distributed logistics using infrastructure we normally wouldn't think about to land airplanes and take off in our highways, for example. Just 2 months ago, the U.S. Air Force conducted an exercise with the Lithuanian Air Force of airplanes taking off and landing on freeways, right? Our American freeway system in the 1940s during the Eisenhower administration was set up on purpose to not only get things across the country, but ensure that that major sections of the freeway were straight and wide enough so that major planes could land, take on supplies, and take back off again for sorties. So you're seeing this idea of making the math really, really hard for someone who wants to strike U.S. or allied targets. The thinking right now is seen as unconventional, but this is the way that people thought and planned about these issues in the previous time of great power competition against the Soviets.
How far away are we from making that a reality? Because I hosted this U.S.-China event back in May, and it came up in my panel that one of our vulnerabilities in fighting an away game in the Indo-Pacific theater is that we essentially have one airbase, presumably Guam, that would make an easy fat target for the Chinese. And because they're in their theater, they've got 39 combat-ready bases. But when you talk about this distributed network of bases and aircrafts being able to land anywhere, and then especially when you look at that map of, like, for instance, the UK Commonwealth map, the French presence in the Indo-Pac, and our ability to leverage all of those locations, it strikes me that we have potentially an even bigger advantage out there. Let me ask you, if, and we go to the point of Taiwan then, if there is some sort of kinetic escalation in the Taiwan Strait, how do you see it playing out?
Yeah, this is a good question. And I think, you know, just to throw a little bit more of kind of parlance into this thinking, when we discuss logistics and where forces are, you hear U.S. military planners and others talk about this idea of setting the theater. So right now, coming up with these new agreements, the shared basing agreement that the United States signed with the Philippines just a few months ago, the U.S. and Japan renegotiating the concentration and the type of representation of our forces in Okinawa, the exercises that we see in Northern Australia right now between the U.S. Marine Corps, the Royal Australian Air Force, and others, the kind of demonstrative of this fact of needing to change things. You know, this question of how would the U.S. react, as you and Grant know, for the longest of times since the United States renormalized relations with Communist China in 1972, we've had this idea of strategic ambiguity, right? That the United States has a one China policy, and that it may, or and that it only desires the unification. Notice I didn't use the phrase reunification, the unification of Taiwan and China only through peaceful means. And the U.S. may or may not come to its aid if it's under attack. And so, you know, how this administration or a future administration would respond, I think it's a little bit difficult to tell. But I do think that all the things that you're seeing play out right now, AUKUS, the U.S. working with Japan to double their ballistic missile inventory, the Quad having a harder edge, the U.S. doing more in the Indo-Pacific, that this isn't just necessarily to get ready for something to happen. This is about putting out both specific, what I call specific and general deterrence to assure something like this never happens to begin with, right? A fun little exercise that I do sometime when I talk to clients about amphibious landings in Taiwan, if you kind of array the challenges the Allies had just in landing in Normandy, 20 odd miles across the English Channel, versus what it would take to go from mainland China across the Taiwan Strait to Taiwan, it's immense. It's significant. And as the U.S. thinks about not just its military instrument of power, but its economic and its diplomatic, these things are all about not only kind of preserving this network of alliances and partners, but this is about deterrence, right? You know, there's a reason why during the Cold War went from potentially hot to cold, because once those lines were drawn across Europe, and after the Korean War was over, the U.S. and its allies and the Soviets and the Warsaw Pact could no longer confront each other head on. They pursued advantages against each other in Latin America, in the Caribbean, in the Middle East through proxy conflicts, right? Deniability. And I think that thing is going to happen again. And there's an economic aspect to it, but there's also a gray zone warfare aspect of it to it, which has an economic dimension.
It's so fascinating. In that U.S.-China event, all the panelists agreed that the key to preventing a kinetic escalation is to convince China that a quick fait accompli, you know, quick confrontation would not happen. Because if things got strung out in a long confrontation, we all know about China's geographic vulnerabilities and its vulnerabilities to food and energy specifically. So the fact that you're talking about these distributed strategies to put the burden of attack, if you will, on China and have the ability to string things out, I think is a phenomenal deterrence strategy.
Before we kind of wrap things up in a minute, I'm just curious from the other side of this, in terms of alliances based around China, alliances that the Chinese are trying to kind of develop. Obviously, they're trying to push back against this and create a framework around themselves that's advantageous. Are there any either existing alliances or alliances that are clearly being attempted to be developed by the Chinese that worry Western strategic policymakers?
I think the potentiality that would keep most people up at night is a further strengthening of Russia and China. Not that necessarily is going to be an alliance or anything close to that, but the greater alignment that you have between the two dominant Eurasian land powers, the more complex and dangerous the world gets, right? And this is one of the concerns of probably the intellectual godfather of geostrategy was a guy by the name of Sir Halford Mackinder. And Mackinder wrote in the early 1900s this idea of the pivot area of the greater Eurasian landmass. And his concern was the technology was getting to such a day that if a power or a series of powers could control all the raw resources that were at heart within Eurasia, they could translate those commodities, oil, steel, coal, and people, into fighting forces that could then challenge the great maritime powers, right? And he wrote this in 1904. History, he was proved right by what happened in World War I, and then again in World War II, and again during the Cold War. So this is the major challenge. I think with the concern about, let's say, China's relationship with North Korea is while China doesn't exactly like everything that North Korea does, North Korea kind of plays the useful fool at times for China, right? It prevents China from having a highly successful democratic free market capitalist country right on its border. It keeps the Americans off Chinese border as long as the Korea Peninsula is divided. You know, as Michael talked about Pakistan, when things get very, very intense for India with Pakistan, one of the things that's in the back of the heads of people in New Delhi is at what point or what level would China exert more influence and create complicating factors in any type of Pakistan-India relationship or conflict or crisis? I like to tell people a story about a few years ago when I flew into Islamabad. I was going to the U.S. Embassy, and the U.S. Embassy was brand new. It was more secure. It had to be because of what was happening in Afghanistan. But on the way to the U.S. Embassy, you drive by the Chinese Embassy, which was new too. And it looked like an Amazon warehouse. It was gigantic, right? And as Michael said, Pakistan is, and China has really doubled down on its relationship with Pakistan. But as Michael said, and I agree, they're not getting the return on investment at Gwadar Port and some of these other areas that maybe they thought.
Myanmar too.
Exactly.
Same thing, ditto for Myanmar.
Yeah. And a lot of that is a function of security within those countries, right? In that southern portion of Pakistan, you've got the Balochis who do not have a love loss for the government there. So there's a lot of... There's a lot of important factors at play when we think about these things. I think you see a coincidence of interest between China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, Myanmar, Venezuela, but it's not necessarily the type of transformational relationship that an alliance structure is, right? And that so far has been one of the saving graces of the West over the last few centuries, is its ability to stand up to authoritarian regimes because of things like transparency, democratic accountability, information sharing, and the limits of the state when it comes to the way that economies perform. But I think looking at the dynamic between China and Russia going forward is going to be an important one. How does the West take action? Don't unnecessarily drive Russia and Chinese grand strategic convergence unnecessarily for too long.
This is a good segue to really my last question for you, which is, in answer to this no limits friendship or informal alliance between Russia and China, there are some that are even calling for NATO to be renamed the New Alliance Treaty Organization and not be just segregated to the North Atlantic. So I'll end with the same question that I started with, which is, do you think there will be a centralized Asian equivalent to NATO? And I guess the second part of that question is, do we really need one?
So to answer quickly up front, I don't think one will necessarily occur. However, I don't think we need one because if managed well, this constellation of security architectures that we've discussed for the last hour and a half can create the same type of effect. Why is an Asian NATO hard? This has been attempted a few times in the past. In the run-up to Vietnam, there was this idea of creating SEATO, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. But everything from geography, the tyranny of distance, the challenge of bilateral relations between countries, we talked about Japan and South Korea's past, as well as just proximity to China and the reliance on China for economics, would make it very, very difficult. It wouldn't necessarily, it's impossible, right? So I think there's that. I think the other thing that's important too is we can't view the birth of NATO outside the context of how World War II ended and what happened following, right? So the first leader of the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, General Sir Hastings Ismay, said that NATO was created to keep the Germans down, the Americans in, and the Russians out, right? So NATO ensured that Europe would no longer be at war with itself, that it would be tied to the new great power that could be an offshore balancer, and it could deter, you know, the great Soviet horde that was at its footsteps, right? But it took going through an epochal war of World War II to kind of get there for Europe, right? But to answer your question, I believe, you know, if managed well, and if done in a true way of mutual respect and long-term thinking and sensitivities to all these different issues that we've discussed, economics, the health of democracies, the strength of militaries, the spending, the trade-off of, you know, the classic guns and butter debate, all those things have to be there. But I think it can be effective. And it will happen naturally as a function of China's behavior. Countries are doing this on their own. They're not being press-ganged to do these things, right?
Scott, I've got to squeeze one more question if I can. We've talked about NATO. We've talked about the China-Russia alliance. Where does all this leave Saudi Arabia? Because obviously they've been very much pro the US bloc for the longest time. The petrodollar agreement kind of cemented that. But now obviously with US self-sufficiency in oil and their biggest customers by far being to the east, and that's likely where they're going to see future demand. How do you guys think about Saudi Arabia as a potential pawn in this geopolitical chess game?
Yeah, Grant, we're seeing a lot of interesting developments because One of the things the Biden administration has been trying to do is to bring about really normalization of ties between Israel and Saudi Arabia. And so for many reasons, which probably be a totally different podcast, there's a lot of reasons kind of motivating this. But one of the things that Saudi Arabia has asked for is the same type of security guarantees, the type of support that Israel gets from the United States. Now, it probably won't get something close to what we have with Israel, right? But a lot of this is being driven by a concern of Iran's long-term behavior. Despite the diplomatic agreement that China helped broker between Saudi Arabia and Iran a few months ago, you know, the Saudis reopened their embassy in Tehran. Some trade has gone back. That Saudi concern, you know, Mohammed bin Salman is still concerned about Iranian nuclear capability, right? And that necessarily has not gone away, to say nothing of Iran's surrogates and proxies that exist both to Saudi Arabia's north and to its south. And so I think what the U.S. is seeing, and Michael and I, when we met in February, we talked about, hey, be careful for Western-flagged oil tankers getting disrupted and seized by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps in the Strait of Hormuz. That's happening right now, again. And so the U.S. administration is currently thinking, well, how do we assure that this doesn't happen? And part of it, Grant, is a need for the U.S. government to explain that while the United States doesn't necessarily need oil and natural gas, LNG, that's coming out of the Gulf, many of our trading partners that we rely on do heavily. Europe does. Before China signed a bunch of recent deals, Japan was the number one importer of LNG globally, right? And the Koreans rely upon it as well. When all that oil has to go through the South China Sea, that gas has to go through the South China Sea as well, again, reinforcing why that area is so important. But it's one of those things where, and I say this to people a lot, both Democrats and Republicans kind of want to turn our back on our engagement in parts of the Middle East, but it's strategic geography for a reason. It is the crossroads of where East meets West, and it has always mattered in great power competition. It has always mattered in global wars, and it's because of geography and commodities, it will always matter going forward. So it's something that the U.S. and the West is going to have to continue to pay attention to. And it gets to a broader question of, is the U.S. military, our Western militaries, big enough right now? Do we have to prioritize? Can we deal with all these things at once? And again, this is where alliances and coalitions become what we call force multipliers going forward. But it takes a global perspective, weighing risks and opportunities, seeing things through its diplomatic, economic, military dimensions that are key and essential for the people at the heights of our governments, both in Washington and Whitehall and Ottawa, Paris, Brussels, to Tokyo, to think through these things, to maintain that global stability, which underwrites all the economic productivity and success that we have enjoyed since the Berlin Wall came down in 1989.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Scott, it's been terrific. Thank you so much for taking the extra time to talk with Michael and I. We had a framework set out before this, and we were worried that we'd be able to get through it all. We knew it was going to go over, so thanks for being so flexible with your time, because it's just been, to say, it's been a fascinating conversation. I'm not sure if there's any way that anyone out there listening can follow you. I'm not sure how public any of your stuff is, but if there is a way that people can follow you, then please let them know, because I'm sure people listening to this will want to stay in touch with how this all develops through you.
Absolutely. I'm accessible via email. I don't know, Michael, if you want to post my email address somewhere.
We can put that in the comments, yep.
I also have a podcast series called Making Sense of Geostrategy, currently on Spotify. And so I'm happy to share all that information in the chat for everyone.
Fantastic. Scott, again, thank you so much. It's been a real privilege. Thank you.
Thanks, gentlemen. Appreciate the opportunity.
Whew, boy, oh boy, oh boy, mate. It's just...
Mind-blowing, right? That was crazy. That was so... When I did my brainstorm with Scott, I couldn't jot down thoughts fast enough, because it just makes you think how complex the situation is.
Yeah. I've long thought it was just the fact that my world has always been finance, but no matter how many of these conversations we have, you cannot help but see how important the financial system and currencies and economic interests are becoming, you know, every day. As each day passes and economic conditions get tougher in so many different places around the world, it just completely tilts the whole playing field of geopolitics and strategic implementation of military plans on its head. It's just almost impossible to keep up with it all.
Yeah.
It just shows you, Michael, how important this conversation is to have. And we're so lucky to have guys like Scott come on and share an insight into this from places that we just don't have.
And I got to tell you, you know, I come away from this conversation with a whole new appreciation for the complexity behind the scenes of holding these structures together from a real practitioner. And I'm incrementally optimistic that because of the decentralized nature of what we have, that we can perhaps convince China that starting some sort of kinetic escalation would be very, very costly to them.
Yeah, I think that's right. That doesn't necessarily mean they will see sense, but you know, certainly conversations like this make you realize just how big the stakes are, and it would be an extraordinary gamble, particularly given the state China's in right now, if they were to decide to escalate this in some kind of kinetic way. Our thanks to our guest, Scott Smitson, for taking that time. We will add the paper Scott wrote to the show notes, or to the transcript rather, because it's a phenomenal read. And that paper contains the maps we referenced in the podcast, which they blew Michael's mind, they blew mine, and I'm pretty convinced they'll blow yours too. We'll be back again with another episode in Chaos Theory in fairly short order. But in the meantime, if you want to follow us on Twitter, you'll find me at TTMYGH.
And me at Urban Cowboy with a K-A-O.
Urban Cowboy with a K-A-O. All right, my friend. Thanks very much for organizing this. It's been a real pleasure as always. I will see you again soon.
Thank you, Grant.
Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.